Hello and welcome to the Comfort Food Zone, which is very like the Comfort Zone, but this time we're talking about food. As ever, we have a special guest who's brought to the table an aspect of culture they'd like us to engage with. And this time, that helping of culture actually comes on a plate. Equally as ever, I'm here with Colm Tobin. Hi, Colm.
Hi, Luke.
How are you feeling about this food pivot we're planning this time?
Not my zone, not my comfort zone.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. That's the way we want it. Well, all of this has been brought about by our guest this time, dairy writer Susanna Dickey. Hello, Susanna. Al Forno treat at the ready.
I hate to do this, but comfort calzone is right there.
Don't hate it. Do it. And she's invited us to engage with something that might be within a lot of comfort zones, though maybe not Colm's, lasagna. But is it something that we can comfortably contemplate? Susanna Dickey's work in poetry and prose isn't afraid to ask the important questions, such as, when was the last time you saw a travelling theatre company? Answers via email. And if you could get shot anywhere, where would it be? On the beach might be nice, one character chirps back. But along with her steam-powered dad gags, her poetry collections such as Isdal and the novels Tennis Lessons and Common Decency, among other things, explore the messy business of being made out of flesh and blood in a language as precise and unstoppable as nuclear fission. And that's why we're talking about lasagna and everything it means to Susanna and maybe to you there listening at home. So for a start, you might expect that when we're talking about lasagna, you'd be talking about the same thing over and over again in repeated patterns. But would that be a bad thing as long as the whole thing sits nicely together, as long as the layers are assembled rhythmically and everything has a place of its own? And sure, isn't that what editing is for? So, Susanna, when was the last time you ate lasagna?
I had lasagna 2 days ago in preparation for this.
I noticed that a character in Common Decency, one of them, a character is avoided because she has a habit of delivering lasagnas of increasingly avant-garde flavours. Is that your issue with lasagna, that it's too mercurial and ever-evolving?
Well, I think the thing is, it's not that I have an issue with lasagna. I think it's that it sits in quite a discomforting position relative to itself, in that it's reflective of the innate porosity, not only of artistic forms like the poem and the novel, but also just our fleshy corporeal forms. I think lasagna becomes quite a neat analogue for basically all the ways in which we try to arbitrarily ascribe categories onto things around us using language, but nothing really can hold. It's untenable. I think the concept of lasagna is largely untenable in the way that language is untenable, and the way the human consciousness is untenable, and the way that artistic genres are also quite fluid.
Okay, before we get into the more general meanings of lasagna, Colm, I think you might be the closest in location to an avant-garde lasagna. I know that because someone from your local Erewhon has delivered an Erewhon vegan organic turmeric lasagna to you, which they say redefines comfort food with a helpful twist. The vibrant turmeric pasta layers are filled with a hearty blend of dry farmed tomato sauce, cashew kale sauce, and soy-free vegan mozzarella. This is organic, a vegan delight, offering a satisfying and guilt-free indulgence. Was that how it felt to you, Colm?
It felt very like California, you know, where if you're speaking of language, it's where really the whole idea of everything being guilt-free and everything being vegan, everything being vegetarian, and people being foodies, meaning that if you're trying to have a normal conversation about something just that's pressing and serious, someone wants to talk about souffle, and it's just not for me. The other thing, I suppose, is that the thing we learned first about lasagna is that not to say lasagna, you know, in other words, that G becomes something very important in your upbringing. At what point in your life, in Enniscorthy or in Derry, or indeed in Dublin, did you stop saying lasagna and start saying lasagna? And did you say it to your parents? At what point did your parents say, what did you just say? Is that how you say that? And so the word itself becomes, I mean, as opposed to, say, spaghetti, the word itself has a hidden little G that is a sign to people that you're in the know, or that you've been in some Italian restaurant, or you've even been in Italy, or you're learning Italian in school, but you're one step ahead of your parents. One of my early meetings with lasagna, I was back from Spain. I was back from somewhere. I was incredibly sophisticated. I was making that very clear at home in Enniscorthy. And my mother, who was very sweet, decided that she really needed to make me things, you know, like instead of beans on toast or, you know, roast lamb or something, that she should make me something very sophisticated. And she decided to make lasagna. And the problem was that she didn't know really know how to. She'd never done it before. And when it came to me, and I was there on my own, it was hard still. It hadn't softened in the oven. Now, this is a real problem about everything you know about manners has to come in now to this. How are you going to deal with the next hour in this house? You don't want to say to her, "Mother, the lasagna is hard. It's not meant to be hard. It's meant to be soft." And then could you put it back in the oven? Could you just get it slowly and put it in your pocket? Yeah, you can. You can put the pasta part, the hard part, in your pocket. But can you put the actual, you know, meat part? Well, you could eat that, I suppose. But it was. It took a very long time for me to say, you know, I think that what happens with this, I think it's meant to soften. No, she said, that's what it said, you know, in the packet. That's what it said. And then, of course, the whole question of pasta softening in the oven, how long it takes in the oven, will the edges burn in the oven? So all those matters. This was a huge matter, by the way, for people in marketing and advertising in Ireland. If they wanted to bring pasta into the Irish household without making it seem a luxury item, they wanted to make it part and parcel of the ordinary fare. They had done this, oddly enough, with yogurt. To make yogurt something that you just normally bought in the supermarket rather than a luxury. And the man who marketed yogurt to the Irish people is the same man who marketed Gareth Fitzgerald to the Irish people. In other words, he went into politics and he saw another opening, you know, that you could have something that was both quite posh or quite, you know, quite grand, but also very practical and good for you. So that he did that first with yogurt and then he did it with a politician. And but the pasta, I mean, I did speak to someone in advertising years ago about the extraordinary leap forward of pasta in Irish, in the Irish supermarket, in the Irish grocery shop, from almost nothing, where you would buy a tin of spaghetti, which was like a tin of baked beans. It had the same sort of tomato sauce. It was utterly delicious. Mm. And it was in a tin. But I don't remember any other pasta being around except that spaghetti. In Spain, they don't do lasagna. They do cannelloni, or cannellones, as they call it. But there's no lasagna in Spain. I think the G might be a problem. And then, of course, there's another problem, which I'll just by finishing saying, the big problem is that if you eat lasagna in Italy, you're expected to eat another course after that. And the lasagna is so filling, the idea of eating a chicken or a fish or anything after it. But this is when you look at an Italian menu, it says first plates, you know, lasagna. You go, how could you eat lasagna and then follow that with half a chicken or chicken?
It has to be a smaller portion, doesn't it? I think.
I know it should be a small portion, but it never is small enough. I don't know what to do about that. It's a huge matter of decorum and manners, which I think all this business of eating Italian things are always about decorum and manners. And it leaves me, certainly my comfort zone has not helped enormously by having to learn a new set of decorum and a new set of manners.
But before we move off there, the other part of decorum and manners you need is towards Hailey Bieber. And I believe along with the lasagna came Hailey Bieber's strawberry glazed skin smoothie, which is part of the care package. Is your skin feeling strawberry glazed?
Look, it's just utterly delicious. And the thing is, I left it in the fridge. And then I sneaked towards the fridge last night at about 11:30. And my partner was in the other room. And I thought, if I just opened the fridge, one of the great skills you learn in any partnership is how to open the fridge really, really quietly. And just with a spoon, with the fridge still open, I ate half it.
This is very bad. We didn't send two, though. I thought it would be an object of disgust and derision in your house.
No,
I didn't think anyone would watch
it. I think it might be, but not for me.
So, I mean, that's kind of, I suppose, in a way, the silly end of the lasagna continuum. But the sensible practicality of lasagna and its portability are maybe why it's attained the status it has as a kind of touchstone of Italian cooking, but also at the same time, a microwave meal basic. In some of its Italian forms, it's a multi-day process with slow-cooked ragu and handmade pasta, which obviously starts off soft and solves the problem of being hard. But all of that preparation sort of speaks of care and maybe a different way of valuing time. Susanna, you've joked about how repeated references to lasagna are one of the most important tools in your poetry toolbox. But the fact that you bring it again to us today suggests that maybe your special relationship with lasagna isn't entirely a joke.
There's something about the nature of lasagna that I keep coming back to. And I think it's to do, I guess, with kind of what it seems to symbolize in a larger ontological sense. One, I think it's one of the funniest foods. I think it's one of the most like inherent food punchlines. But say we take, for example, the fact that Garfield loves lasagna and hates Mondays. And if we understand the Monday to be indicative of the kind of contrived labor week, the point at which civilians are kind of funneled back into being productive engineers of capital. If we understand lasagna to be the antithesis of that within the polarity of Garfield's likes and dislikes, then lasagna is inherently reflective of something that is antithetical to capitalism. And so this is where we get into it, because if you think about the structure of the lasagna, the kind of inherent layers that we aspire to keep distinct from one another, yet that form part of one intact whole. And if you think about that structure in terms of so many things, like you can think about in terms of other food stuff, like tiramisu is dessert lasagna, moussaka is Greek lasagna. But if you look at the structure of skin on a human, and if you Google skin diagram, you know, you're presented with the epidermis, the hypodermis, the subcutaneous tissue. It all sits in these very neat little strata, in these little layers, in the way that a lasagna does. But ultimately, what we're looking at is just human skin. We understand the human as an intact whole, despite these strata. But there's an Italian physicist called Carlo Rovelli, who writes about kind of how humans use language essentially as a way to bestow arbitrary demarcations upon the natural world around us to understand it better. And he says something like, how do you know when the mountain ends? You know, when the mountain becomes the land, but the actual terrain of what makes the mountain continues down through the different strata of the Earth's crust. We have just decided almost arbitrarily that we're going to call the bit of it that we can see above land a mountain, and everything around it of which it is attached to and made up of is not mountain. And also, this is another thing. So if you think about of the synecdoche of the word lasagna, because lasagna means not just the pasta sheets pre being part of the dish, it's also the complete dish in and of itself. And that's confusing because, you know, because Carlo Rovelli says, oh, if I cut my fingernail off, is that still part of me? Does that cease to be part of me? Or is it a part of me that is now entirely distinct? Or is it still innately me? And if you think about the construction of the lasagna, there will be mince, there will be tomatoes, there will be pasta, all sitting separately prior to assembly. And do we decide those materials are lasagna pre-lasagna assembly? Because if they're destined to ultimately be lasagna, are they always lasagna? And if they're not lasagna, what is it that makes them lasagna once they're assembled within the lasagna, if they still try and retain their structural integrity once they're made lasagna? And that's interesting to think about. But if you think about that in terms of the novel or a poem, we come up with these distinct facets that we decide contribute to an intact artistic whole. But the novel or the poem becomes its own innate, vibrant ecosystem, the quality of which is determined by some alchemical combination of these distinct literary tropes and techniques. And yet the novel becomes the lasagna once it's the novel, but the language that makes it, that pre-exists the novel, is also the novel in a way that the pasta sheets are also the lasagna.
Would that mean then that a page of a novel would be that the blank space in between each line are the layers of pasta?
Yes.
And the actual sentences, the print, is whatever sauce, whatever set of tomato or what aubergine or, is there aubergine? Or minced meat or whatever, all the other things you want to put in are the things between. And you, what you do is you move layering each page. But the issue, of course, is that once you put the thing in the oven, those pasta, I suppose, tectonic plates, they melt or they soften, which I think is better. They don't actually melt, they soften.
Yes.
I think soften is nice because maybe that's another way of thinking about not only writing, but being in the world where something that's brittle, meaning memory, experience, words themselves, things, that in order for them to come into being as experience or as to come into being as even as, let's say, as sentences, something has to happen in between the actual feeling and the thing in words which represents the feeling. And you could say, yeah, okay, if you want, that this could be something like hard pasta that softens in heat. And that metaphor is lovely because it suggests that the cooking, but it's not, you see, it's not just cooking. It is that this brittle pasta has to soften. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really have to cook, it just has to soften. And that may be a way to represent the whole idea of what happens to memory when it needs to move into language, or what happens to memory when it needs to move into image, or what happens to memory when you need to formulate it in some way. Yeah, that idea, it's not necessarily cooking, but it's softening and not exactly melting, but it's becoming palatable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the way we transcribe experience, feeling and thought into language in order to make a kind of meaningful, effective piece of art requires a certain chemical alteration or like transmutation process, much like what the lasagna undergoes while cooking to make it palatable. Exactly.
So you don't eat meat and you don't eat fish and you don't do dairy.
Yes, exactly.
You are a vegan.
Yeah, yeah.
What else is it? I mean, they're carrots, I suppose, parsnips.
Well, this is another interesting thing. They've come up with lots of very, I was about to say convincing. They're not convincing in the slightest. They've come up with like synthetic alternatives to all the kind of original ingredients. You know, you can have fake meat, you can have fake cheese, fake cream, all of those things. And you can make a sort of makeshift simulacrum of an authentic lasagna.
But there is no authentic lasagna. There is no lasagna out there, because is it a northern Italian lasagna or one from Naples? And those themselves will vary. And there's a Ligurian lasagna, which is actually pesto with the pasta rather than any kind of ragu. One of the interesting things, of course, is the lasagna is sheets of paper. So it's very interesting that writers might be interested in it. It's like it is the beckoning sign for anybody to write. It's like a blank sheet, address this, fill this up. But there is also this thing that it's not actually something that you can pin down and define, even though the internet is absolutely stuffed with recipes to make the ideal, the perfect lasagna.
Could you just stop with the word ragu, which seems the least Italian word, doesn't it? Ragu.
Yeah.
And it sounds like if you went into an Indian restaurant and ordered some ragu, they would know what you wanted. But it's funny the way ragu.
Yeah, ragu.
It's sounds like something you could get arrested for. Like it happened after the pub closed on a Friday evening. There was a bit of a ragu going on.
Is ragu not just mincemeat?
I think it can be a lot of different meats, but in a good sense that it's very slowly cooked, I think. There's a sort of disintegration of the meat, which obviously sounds like a perversion to, and it's something I see a lot in Susanna's writing. Like, it sounds like a bit of a perversion. You want the animal to dissolve into tomato so that it, you know, can transform completely into food. I wanted to ask you, Colin brings up the question of, you know, how might a vegan approach a lasagna? But I think it's...
With caution.
Well, it's a bigger question of how a vegan approaches the world, isn't it? I mean, I think being a vegan makes you...
I think typically quite tediously.
Well, is it? you know, it's you could say, I often think that you can say a lot of things about being a vegan, but it's not convenient. It's really not convenient. But it makes you think about the world in a certain way that is kind of like a religious vision, a kind of blinding insight that's very difficult to come back from. And it's not just that the where it comes from that, you know, you think about in every moment, but it makes life in general seem like a business of just ignoring things, and that a lot of our everyday lives are spent in ignoring things, and that being a vegan is that moment when you see things and you can't go back in a way. What degree of a vegan are you? Tell us about your life, you know, your vision of a supermarket. I mean, I'm assuming that all this food analogies and metaphors that crop up in your writing come from that sort of vegan consciousness of a certain kind of status in all the things around you that people are consuming.
Well, I mean, I guess I think of a lot of artistic production as being some kind of response to an understood deficiency within the self. And in my case, it's a calcium deficiency. But yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, you hear about these kind of little quirks of human consciousness, these things that can go wrong in the human brain, where, for example, a person one day loses the capacity not to move their limbs, but to understand their own volition over their limb movements. You know, they can still move their limbs, but they can exert no active, willful control over how their limbs move. So their arms just sort of float up at random. Just these little kind of quirks of the human brain's inherent frailty.
I think the hippies used to call it getting hung up. There's the idea that if you thought too long about how your tongue works, you might actually just lose the power of speech because it doesn't bear thinking about is the basic.
Well, I guess also like semantic satiation, you know, like you think too long about any one word, it becomes fundamentally, ultimately unrecognizable to you in a really horrifying way. So I guess veganism is kind of that, except it's trying to make previously unfamiliar things so familiar to you that you're no longer able to eat them, which is why I don't eat most of my friends. I've just known them for too long.
Colm, I mean, have you spent any time when you didn't eat meat or when it became an issue for you?
Yeah, yes, I did about 10 years ago. I did 6 months as a vegetarian, and also I didn't want to eat fish. And I grew passionate. I mean, it's like not. I mean, I don't drink alcohol now. I'm quite passionate about, you know, that other people should join me in this. But my sermon was, we should learn to leave things alone. You know, and then someone said, well, what about a parsnip? And I said, well, yeah, but it's not like a fish that can, a parsnip can't look at you. But the idea of killing, the idea of killing animals, especially killing cows and sheep and pigs, cutting their throats or shooting them, and the fact that the abattoir is not something anyone wants to see. And also the horrible business of fishing, of getting a fish and taking it out of its element and almost smothering it in a horrible way. And there's an awful look on the fish's face in those last seconds of its life. So I got quite passionate on the subject until Miami. And the problem was that I had to go to Key West to do a something completely unnecessary, meaning a reading from my work, you know, as though they were desperate in Key West to hear me. And it involved flying, and I just hadn't made any arrangements. You know, you're meant to put on the plane that you only will eat cheese or something. And I didn't do this, and they had no vegetarian food on the long flight to Miami. And then there was a 5-hour wait at Miami airport. There wasn't a single thing to eat that didn't have meat in it. And I gave up. I think it was New Year's Day. I gave up and I started eating meat again. And I'm doing that ever since. But it's wrong. And people should stop doing it. And it's wrong. I think what Susanna's saying about, you know, saying, well, I don't eat my friends. But I think that's serious, because how could you eat? If you wouldn't eat a dog for one reason, you wouldn't eat a rat for another. How come you'd eat a sheep? And what does it say about you that you would do that? And why don't you stop?
Can you get back there to that position where you didn't? I mean, that terrible incident on the flight to Miami is one thing, but what you know is still there, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm completely guilty and completely wrong, and I'm going to do it again soon. But I mean, giving up, not drinking alcohol, but I'm 5 or 6 years at that now. So I need a new cause. to go around bodily exclaiming, look at me, I don't eat meat or fish.
I presume that Erewhon turmeric lasagna may not be the key to your path into veganism. I mean, Susanna, it's not just, of course, lasagna. It's very noticeable that a major store cupboard of meaning for you is food. And a couple of food phrases, they stuck with me, and I wanted to say them so that people could hear them. You talk about somebody in a state of denial, the carpaccio of her denial. And I thought, is that very slight, thin, or just raw? Chest like Wagyu beef. I thought, no idea, none.
Well, you know the way that the cows that ultimately become Wagyu beef are very tenderly massaged prior to expiry. And so I guess I was just thinking about my own mammaries as things that are typically quite regularly fondled.
Apology, back to lasagna, apology lasagna from the mini fridge. Better than nothing, I thought.
Yeah. I'm just going back to this ragu thing. It sounds like a name of a daughter in a Trollope novel, doesn't it? You know, when you're reading Anthony Trollope, it'll be like the gatekeeper's four daughters were called Elizabeth, Eliza, Genevieve and Grizzle. He had this real capacity to include one really weird name at the end, and it sounds like Ragu could be the fifth daughter to the lighthouse keeper.
I want to imagine coming home that time where, you know, my mother's just trying to be nice to me and thinking I'm all sophisticated, and she's getting me the lasagna, and I have a book with me. And it's that lovely business, especially in Ireland, of having a book of poetry with you, and someone saying, what's that? And the poet is from Derry. So you immediately think, oh, Derry. Derry people write wonderful poetry. You know, we sort of know their poetry. And there's usually a poem about your mother, there's a poem about your father, and there's a poem about your childhood. And so I produced the book. And my mother, this is an imagined moment, and it's now. And my mother, who likes poetry, says, oh, Bloodthirsty for Marriage by Susanna Dickey. And I'm looking at this book, and it's a pamphlet. And there's something lovely and harmless about pamphlets. And you often should have pamphlets because they often become very valuable in later years when the poet becomes immensely famous. And this is sort of an early pamphlet, often produced in very small numbers. But this really would take work for me to explain at home what you're doing. In other words, what seems to be happening in a poem is that you're interested, first of all, in not just the sound of words, but taking up words that are often used as cliche, or often just come into the mind for a second and go out again. You're not necessarily interested in narrative, but you are interested in a sort of getting the sound of the words to be persuasive and convincing in the way the lines work, in the way the next line comes. The poems are filled with surprises. The surprises seem to me to be the result of a very, very interesting mind. Yes, there is food. There's bring me seed oil, bring me sun-dried tomatoes. This is my new Christ metaphor. Or the horseshoe in a margarita. And soon I will consume the bird. It will in turn consume me. But it's not the food metaphors I'm as interested in here as your general tone, which is very far from what we associate with Irish poetry. But yet, I feel there's a very serious mind at work attempting to reform ideas of what we think poetry is, and also allowing your own mind to paying due attention to the way the mind works, in the same way as Joyce might in Ulysses Let Leopold Bloom have a tiny thought for no reason that doesn't add to the narrative, but adds to our delight as we watch him think. And that your poems take their bearings, say, from Joyce. If you're looking at Irish origins, Joyce rather than Yeats. In other words, the sparkling mind, the mind as a monkey, the mind moving from one thing to another, phrases coming in and out, phrases that seem delightful. So the poems persuade in that way. Now, I'm trying to bring this back around to the idea of lasagna, but I'm failing miserably. But this pamphlet, just taking this on its own, seems to me to be creating something entirely new in Irish poetry, pushing Irish poetry in another direction, away from the narrative, away from the easily explained, away from the sonorous, away from using, I suppose, memory and meter together, you know, memory and meter rhyme in the same way as hope and history. It's memory and meter that you're actually attempting to sometimes usurp that and play with it. But I have to say, I think you're great. And I think this is the most fascinating pamphlet. I got nothing but pleasure from it. I mean, it made me smile. But more than that, it made me look again at the whole way that this tradition of ours, just say, you use the word Derry. Oh, she's a Derry poet. And you go, oh, there's a lot you can do to make that up as you go along, or reinvent it, or destroy it, or usurp it, or play with it.
I liked something you said, Susanna, about, and I think Colm and yourself both have this thing where you move from poetry to novels and inhabit both these forms in interesting ways. And one thing you said about poetry was that there was some kind of, if I understood you, there was some kind of escape from being an I that could be kind of defined and read, or, you know, that you had to make this performance of a certain kind of I, and that poetry put you somewhere else.
Well, because I guess I'm interested in terms of how poetry as a genre can enable and facilitate this kind of new, consistently reintroducing oneself to language and how language works. And you see, if you understand the poem as a kind of engine form, it's very noticeable, I feel like, when you're writing a poem and when you're in the flow with a poem, you become conscious that the way the language works and the way the language invites you and resists you as you function within that engine, to notice this kind of almost collaborative medium whereby the language has its own agenda and intentions and you're sort of wrangling with it. And I think once you're doing that, you become very self-conscious, I guess, of your status as author, your kind of authorial integrity. You recognize that, oh, this form is actually me working in tandem with something over which I actually have very little authorial control. And the end product is therefore this synthesis between what you choose and the choices you make and the kind of unconscious choices. The poem for me feels like a really powerful, quite rare opportunity to get to grips with all the strange and the alien and the unknown within the self. You know, the human body is comprised, and human consciousness is comprised of so much we don't understand and we are fundamentally unfamiliar with. We're so composed of non-human, even at, like, you know, a skin level, a flesh level, bacteria, all these processes, if taken outside of the realm and parameter of the human body, we would identify as, oh, that's not human, that's not me, but it is you, because we are weird sort of flesh menageries, you know, like horrible skin ecosystems. And the poem to me feels like a really interesting confrontation, I guess, with that. And I think in that pamphlet, in Bloodthirsty for Marriage, I was really especially interested in that, because if you understand the rich Irish tradition of writing as being inherently bound up with shame and, like, guilt and a kind of self-directed fearfulness, that kind of shame, I guess, I feel about my own authorial presence feels inherently Irish. But I think another thing, particularly in that pamphlet, was I was using this form called the Hendica syllable, which is an 11-syllable line. And what was really interesting when I would show those poems to my English friends is they'd be like, oh, you've miscounted the syllables here. And it's like, no, I haven't. It just so happens that I ascribe that word a different number of syllables to how you do with your RP. So that felt inherently Irish to me.
Yeah, which, oh God, give us one of those words.
I mean, they're, God, well, I mean, I've obviously got an accent from the north as well, so
I couldn't tell.
It's almost our raison d'etre in this life to put more syllables in words.
Would medieval be one? Medieval?
yeah, medieval.
I think Yeats talks about his medieval knees, I think, meaning he's getting older. But I would say medieval, you see, and someone would say, what did you just say, medieval? medieval.
Some people medieval? Say, yeah, just like medieval. Yeah, I would say medieval.
Is it possible that that some of Shakespeare's lines in the plays have 11 syllables rather than 10?
I think almost certainly. I think any time, for example, he's using a word like fire, sometimes in the English accent, fire becomes like fa.
Ah, yeah. I mean, the big one is my name, my first name, because it you have to, in order to explain how to pronounce it to someone who's not Irish, you have to say Irish people say film. So LM becomes a syllable, film. Did you see any good films recently? And my name is Cullum. So that's a great example of adding a syllable. I know that Jorge Luis Borges translated some of Shakespeare, and he did it in Spanish with 11 syllable lines, with I think 5 beats, but you can just get an extra little thing at the end. The curfew tolls the knell of parting deo. Daedlow. The curfew tolls the knell of parting daedlow.
I mean, that's lovely. That's pure poetry.
So you counted the syllables in every line in these poems, and you got 11. Did you count the beats in the line?
No, I didn't count the beats. Yeah, I stuck exclusively to syllabics for this one. And partly that was to do with, apparently historically, the Hendika syllable was used as a kind of shameful form for writing about horniness. It was like a typically horny form, sexy form. Catullus was big into it. And I guess that was my primary focus on the pamphlet Bloodthirsty for Marge, was I wanted to try and like think about shameful desire and kind of rampant lustiness.
Cheesecake.
Yes, cheesecake. Exactly. Exactly.
Could you explain syllabics?
Oh yeah, so syllabics, like, so the number of syllables in a line. So Hendika syllable is an 11 syllable line.
So in other words, in a poem, when you're looking, what form can I use in this poem? If it's not going to be a sonnet, if it's not going to have stanzas, if it's not going to have a sound, can it just go all over the page? No, I don't want it to go just all over the page. I want it to have a certain form. So the big one would be to use, say, 7, just to count the syllables, to have, say, 7 syllables. And that's how you make the form, but not that there's a beat in the form. It's died out very much, hasn't it, syllabics? It was a form that was much more there in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah. I think, we're very firmly, because you have obviously come to poetry now, because you were obviously in the Carcanet New Poetries a couple of years ago. Yeah. Like, what prompted your pivot? Because I don't think you wrote a huge amount of poetry before then, did you? Publish it?
Between the age... Well, I didn't publish it because no one would publish it for me. I mean, it wasn't that I didn't try, but between the ages of 12 and 20, I wrote poems probably sometimes every day. I then learned by the time about 16 or 17 to start revising poems, which I hadn't done before. But when I was 20, it stopped. And so I was a failed poet, an ex-poet. I was a poet without a poem, which is a sort of sad idea. So I was probably the only person who was reading poetry all the time without writing it.
Which is the holy grail, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. I was exactly the person everyone was looking for. Is there someone in Ireland who isn't writing poetry who might actually come to a poetry reading?
And when you were writing that, did that relate to your vocation? Was it religious verse at the time?
No, it wasn't. It was just anything that came in. I mean, I wrote a poem, called There's Blood Flowing Out of the Rose Bowl. And I mean, I was 15 at the time, and I wrote a poem called There's Blood Flowing Out of the Rose Bowl. So I must have had things on my mind. unfortunately, which is a warning to everyone young, I sent these poems to a Capuchin magazine. Capuchin Order had a magazine called Eirig. It was a magazine for teenagers. It was very literate and serious. And they published some of them, but they kept all of them, and they're in their archive. And you can go into their archive now and you can read my outpourings between the ages of about 12 and 16. And it's not nice. It's not ordinary. It's not good. And that's what I mean. They wrote to me a while ago to say, just to let you know that our archive is now really coming up. And I was going to say, please don't digitize. Please don't digitize. Please don't digitize. And what happened then was, after I wrote one of the novels, it was a big novel and it was a lot of rewriting, I was just, I was just wordless. In other words, I had every day I was used to doing this, and now I had no novel. And these little poems came. And in a way, the more abstract they were, the happier I was, where I felt I'd been putting so much people into rooms. If someone is in the room, they must be in the room for the next sentence and the one after. They cannot just be in another country, suddenly because you want them to be. But poetry is really extraordinary, especially now, where you can just say, well, that winter, you know, he lived in Australia before he came. You know, you can move people to countries, but you can also move moods. You can also just put any word you want into the poem and see if it sticks, as though you're throwing things, as though the poem can be abstract. I just had a poem and I put the word just in a line, one comma, one comma, one, full stop. It's just there because it came into my mind. It could be Beethoven Opus 111, which is the great, one of the last piano sonatas, which has no last movement, which, I mean, it could be a reference to that, but not really. It's just there because as I was working along, I thought, one, 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 one. And I used to envy poets. I used to envy poets, particularly poets who were trying not to write sort of memory poems or personal poems, but to try and find something to do with language that would stick to the wall, that like you would make a big abstract painting, you could make a poem that would be abstract, but whose feelings, the level of emotion could be equal or even greater than a poem that would be, for example, a narrative poem or a personal poem, which is why finding Bloodthirsty for Marriage has been just great for me.
Susanna has taken kind of the opportunity to write. I don't know how common this is, but she has a long poem that deals a lot with podcasting. And I think, oh, that's my first podcasting poem. I don't know if you know that one, Colm. It's called Isdal. The collection is called Isdal.
No.
Tell us a bit about Isdal, Susanna, because that is actually the sequence where your sort of lasagnaization kind of comes most into focus, or came maybe first into focus. But tell people who don't know about that collection how that works, what it's about.
So that collection is about, well, ostensibly it takes as its subject matter this this woman called the Isdal woman, she's now known as, who is a woman who was discovered in the ice valley in Bergen in Norway in 1970 and who has never been successfully identified, and she's become fodder for a lot of true crime media and the engine of true crime because she's a very appealing subject in many respects for that form, because she remains a character over whom a lot of questions float and orbit, and she becomes a very rife catalyst for amateur sleuthery and narrative speculation. So there was a podcast made about her that I decided to attempt to satirize.
The BBC podcast.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I attempted to satirize that in the form of a very, very long poem.
I mean, true crime is a very interesting area for podcasting. And I mean, one of the things that happens in the book is that you're kind of imagining how, you know, how they would fake the sound of things, like terrible things and ordinary things. Like, what would the world look like if it just came through a mic? What would it sound like if it just came through a microphone?
Yeah, well, true crime is a form that tries its best to conceal and deny its own inherent artifice, which I think poetry is almost the antithesis of. Like, I think good poetry is very, very aware of its own artifice, and true crime pretends there is no artifice, you know? But then if you think about things like Foley artists and the creation of the simulacra of sounds, you know, like you can't get a horse in the studio, so instead you're going to hit two bits of a coconut together. That's almost entirely what poetry is, you know, like it's an attempt to make a horse out of a coconut. So, like, you know, if we think of poems, there's this idea of the vessel. You pick this arbitrary little box or stanza. There's an American psychoanalytical writer called John Steen who has this book all about psychoanalysis and American poetry. And he says in it, you know, poets are enamored of well-wrought urns. You know, we're seeking these beautiful little vessels via which to contain this huge overspill of messy, problematic, fearful emotion. And again, true crime almost seems like the opposite of that. It's this kind of sprawling, artificial narrative that attempts to relay truth, but its relation to truth, or what truth even is so messy and problematic and strange. It almost imposes onto the real forms for which it is completely ill-suited. So I thought it would be a fun exercise.
It's also very much predicated on kind of the consumption of violence against women.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think that the largely female demographic for true crime makes a lot of sense when you think about it. If you're the voyeur or if you're the detective, you're not the victim. And because the people who invariably are the subject matter are women or queer people or people of colour or disabled people or people who inhabit subsections of society most typically predisposed to violence, you know, if maybe you want a moment to kind of step out from under that mantle and become the voyeur, become the detective, so that you can just for a moment cease identifying with the victim, because as long as you're identifying with the victim, you're having to confront the fact that this could happen to you really at any given moment. And that's exhausting. I think that demographic skew makes a lot of sense. But I think the poem for me, because I have been a participant in that demographic, I've consumed a huge amount of true crime adjacent media in my time. If you understand the rich Irish tradition of writing as being inherently bound up with shame, and poetry, as I was saying, is so bound up with shame for me, and this is something about which I feel a huge amount of shame, it is my consumption of this material. It felt obvious to me that poetry would find a neat form within that. And because lasagna to me is also inherently bound up with shame, apology lasagna becomes this kind of recurring trope within the poem. You know, one of the male podcasters keeps offering his female colleague apology lasagna as a way of saying, sorry, I'm being such a hapless oaf throughout this recording. And the book to me, the poetry collection, is my apology lasagna to the wider literary community.
I think there's another way that lasagna can deal with shame, which is there's a huge amount of shame about spaghetti. Now, this is because Irish people, not just Irish people, but English people, French people, don't know how to eat it. When I started in the business of spaghetti, I thought that you had a spoon and that you had the spoon in one hand and then you had the fork in the other and you wound the spaghetti around the fork using the spoon as a sort of anchor in the air. And then you got enough to put it into your mouth. But Italians, they think this is the most shameful. It's not just a failure of table manners. It's a failure of full style. It's a failure of personality. It's a failure of character. You do not have a spoon in your hand when you're eating spaghetti. You should be able to curl enough spaghetti onto a fork. Moving the spaghetti, the plate has to be cold because when you move the spaghetti to the edge of the plate, it hardens slightly and will thus harden on the fork. But you have to know how to do this. If you don't know how to do this, you don't know how to do this. The other thing is, if you ever thought of, for example, giving spaghetti to someone with meatballs, which is a big American thing, spaghetti and meatballs, it's very hearty, it's very nice. An Italian will say, you cannot eat anything else on the plate with the spaghetti. Lasagna solves this problem to some extent because you just it's you and a fork. Like, you don't have the big problem of how to get this pasta into your mouth. You just simply use the fork to cut it and you put it into your mouth then. So I think it's a much easier thing to eat. And I think Italians despise you less when they watch you. But there's also the whole question of, should you have a salad on another plate? You know, what point should the salad be? Should the lasagna be done in squares? What type of square? You know, there's so many rules governing the whole business of going near Italian food that you might be just better with having mashed potatoes and corned beef.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, the formal kind of complexity that surrounds how we approach and eat lasagna, it's a lot like, I guess, how we approach kind of just being human, being alive, but also how we create art, you know, like these decisions around how you approach form, how you approach consumption. Yeah.
That brings us back to the place where we want to be, where lasagna tells us about literature and literature tells us about lasagna. It's a good place to stop. I'm pretty sure that I'll be giving the contents of my fridge side eye a bit later on. Thank you, Susanna Dickey, for bringing lasagna. I'll give you back your Pyrex when I see you again. And thank you, Colm, for eating turmeric lasagna. Never again, maybe.
Well, thank you for the great gift.
And thank you, everybody else, for listening. I hope, in the words of Isdal's true crime sleuths, that our podcast passes the Bechamel test. Bye now.
Thank you.
That
very
was wonderful. Thank you very much. I just wanted to say you went away there, Colin, when I was going to say that I love the way that Japanese culture has removed shame, so that you just insert one end of the noodle, the spaghetti, into your mouth and suck. And that sorts all that problem out. Yeah. No more messing about. But anyway, it's a very swift handbrake turn from lasagna into true crime and back out again. But you performed
it
expertly.
We have fun.